had that chapter in Isaiah, which speaks of very ostentatious behavior, read to raise a question for you, what on earth that's got to do with the priestly blessing. May the Lord bless thee and keep thee. And the subsequent verses, which we find in the sixth chapter of Numbers. Well, the answer is in a burial ground, which is just to the south of Jerusalem. That pretty good focus for you? Yeah. The site is called Ketuv Hinnom, and it's just to the southwest of the city of Jerusalem, and the it's on the road going south to Bethlehem, and it was the Turkish fort, which was built there around 1500, was built to protect the southern approaches to Jerusalem. And interestingly, when you excavate it, you find all sorts of bits and pieces there reminiscent of a military occupation. There are rifles and clay pipes and things like that. And then from about 400 to 700 AD, there was a Byzantine church. And in the Byzantine period, there were pilgrimages to the sites. And this church was one of the pilgrim sites which those who were following the journey of Mary when she went to Jerusalem would have followed. There's a little one a little further down. Thanks, Mike. Which is one of the sites that Mary is supposed to have rested on her way to Jerusalem, on her way to Bethlehem. Prior to that, it was a burial site. The Roman 10th Legion was there at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem under Titus and stayed there to keep the peace for a number of years. We know that it's the 10th Legion because there are inscriptions on building blocks and tiles from that period which define this as being the 10th Legion. Interestingly, during the later period of the around 2-300 AD, the Romans had a habit of cremating their legionnaires. And the remains of the legionnaire would be cremated and his ashes put inside the pot that he had to prepare his food and left there. And that's the way a lot of this area is discovered. Earlier than that, there were, of course, some skeletal burials. And interestingly, there's a coin in the head of one of the skeletons which was found. And that, no doubt, was the coin that the Romans put in the mouth of the deceased in order to pay the ferryman to cross the river Styx, you recall. Earlier than that, in the Herodian period, at the time when the Jerusalem that Jesus saw was being built, it was used as a quarry to build the city that was so elaborate and attracted so much attention in Jesus' day, the city that Herod had built. Prior to that, we now go back to the time of the kings, and if you recognize the dates, the period spans the Babylonian conquest. The Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem in 586, so it's right in the middle of the period in which these graves were used by wealthy Jewish families. So in the later years of the time of the kings, the first temple period, and shortly after that, when the Babylonians had conquered Israel and taken possession of Jerusalem and its environs, people were being buried in these caves. Now, they were opened up caves, and there were mausoleums built over them. And the design of the cave was, it's quite interesting, because there were notches put into the a stone bench, and the deceased would lie on the bench with his head in a notch and the body in a slight depression. About a year later, when the flesh had all gone from the bones, the bones were picked up and put into an area which was down below the bench, a little further down into the burial chamber, along with all the things that had been buried with that individual. So here we have the start of the grave contents, which were there and which were uncovered. There were 95 individuals buried. And then there's one limestone seal. One limestone seal, and the name on the seal is Pelatiah. Now, this is a seal which is in reverse, so that when you take it and imprint it on a block of clay, you can read the letters. It's a mirror image of what you want. There's a palm branch on it, and this was typical of the period around the time of the Babylonian conquest. Quite interestingly, we have in Ezekiel the name Pelatiah. It's in the 11th chapter of Ezekiel. Now, there's no way of knowing whether the Pelatiah in Ezekiel was the one who owned the seal or not. But what it says quite clearly is that at the time when this burial chamber was being used, that name was in use in Judea. And not only that, it says that the name was being used by an influential individual in the time of Zedekiah, actually. So, first verse of Ezekiel 11, if you want to look it up, there he is, and is mentioned again a little further down in the 13th verse. So, what we're seeing then, is that the contents of the burial chambers fit with the at least some of the things that were going on, with the names that were happening, there, being used there. 45 iron arrowheads. Well, fascinating. Why have 45 arrowheads in a burial chamber, in the tomb? Why have that buried with you? Well, if we think of what was going on in Jerusalem during the latter years of the period of the kings, and then in the early interval after the Babylonians had overtaken Jerusalem, we find the stories of almost continuous warfare between Egypt, a series of invasions by the Babylonians. Prior to that, the invasion by Sennacherib of Assyria, and so on. It went on almost continuously for many years. So the idea that people would have weapons of some sort as part of their possessions is not at all to be unexpected. And indeed, if you look at the way the book of Jeremiah, and interestingly, Jeremiah is not strictly chronological, so what I'm saying now isn't necessarily fit the idea of a sequence in time. But the latter half of Jeremiah uses the word army a great deal. It talks a lot of armies which will invade. It talks a lot of rearming the Jewish populace. And the story of arrowheads and spears, where words like that become more common as you work towards the end of the prophecy of Jeremiah. So again, what was going on in the prophets and what we see in the tomb fit. There's one bronze arrowhead. And this is interesting because it's a Babylonian design. So almost certainly it was a Babylonian weapon. Now, how that came to be buried in a Jewish tomb is something that you can speculate on, and there are some interesting ideas that one can come up with for that. But nonetheless, again, the weaponry fits the time period, and it fits the story that we have in the book. Come on down a little further, the knife and the iron chisel, and probably used as a stonemason's tool. And so it speaks again of the defensive maneuvers of the Jews at a time when they were being threatened by the Egyptians to the south, by the Babylonians from the east, and so forth. The bone handles are interesting because there's only one other place in the Middle East where they have been found, and that's on a Greek island. And they are, you know, the large bones and leg bones of animals and so forth, with the hole right to the middle of them. So you can put small metal prong through and weld that onto a cooking pot. So there are kitchen things there, at least a few of them. Spindle whorls, needles, sticks for applying makeup, eye make eyeliner and things of that nature. That's what they were used for in those days. Bronze buttons, an alabaster cosmetic dish, and a series of items which undoubtedly were inlays, but the wooden boxes and the wooden structures which once held those inlays have long gone. And there's a whole series of other things included in the tomb. And this, when it happened, was quite exciting for the archaeologists, because you almost never find an undisturbed tomb from this period. But with the earlier looting and the destruction of armies coming through, had caused enough damage that there had been enough debris over the area where these bones and their possessions were kept, that nobody had seen them until the an Israeli archaeologist in the 1990s, Gabriel Bachai, found the site interesting and excavated it and worked his way all the way down to these tombs. This top item is very interesting. It speaks of several things, of wealth and an attraction for artistic things, and it speaks of an advanced technology. Glassblowing wasn't known until much later. So this little juglet, an amphora, you realize, has a pointed base. And so it's a little jug that looks something like that. And it was formed by making a core of material that you could chip out easily. They used dung and sand and things like that to make a shape. And then you dip that into molten glass, and the glass adheres to it, lifted out quickly. And then they decorated it by putting little strips of colored glass on it while it was still hot. And then they had to cool it slowly, otherwise it would have cracked. So you see, there was a lot of technology involved. But also, it's one of those things that people would have used for something expensive. And if you think in New Testament terms of the oil that was used to anoint the feet of Jesus towards the end of his life, it would be something of that value that would be kept in that little glass jar by someone who had enough money to buy the jar and to put something expensive in its contents. I don't want to say too much about the pottery for the moment, but 250 pottery items, and they were complete. So they were obviously laid there with the deceased and then picked up when the bones were removed and put down beneath. But the jewelry... And there's two groups of jewelry here. There's a lot of silver, a little bit of gold, a lot of beads, a lot of things of that nature. And interestingly, then, we have this list that was read to you from Isaiah 3. While you have those on the screen, I would like to read a bit of it to you again. And this comes from a translation of Isaiah, of the several scrolls of Isaiah, which were found in the Dead Sea. So it's a translation made about 10 years ago. In that day, my Lord will take away the beauty of their anklets and headbands and crescents and pendants and bracelets, veils and turbans, armlets and sashes, perfume boxes, amulets, and signet rings, and nose rings, and festal robes, mantles, purses, mirrors, fine linen, headdresses, and veils. And then instead of perfume, and then it goes on. And as we said a little earlier, it was not just the women that were singled out by the prophets, even though they are treated very, very significantly in that. But it was also the men that were singled out by the prophets in many cases for the elaborate hats and gowns which they wore. We have that description, and that is a little before a series of tombs were going to be used. There's another description, and it's in the 16th chapter of Ezekiel. And there it's in two parts. In the first part of the 16th chapter of Ezekiel, the Lord God is saying that the prosperity which their people had gained he had given them. So whatever jewelry, whatever property they had, came to them from God. And then at the end of that chapter, the tables are turned, as we say nowadays. And God is pointing out that because of the way they had behaved, all of those things would go. So, this whole question of jewelry surrounds the time frame in which the tombs were being used. I want to move on down now to this, and now we're getting to the point where we're going to answer the question that we had first off. What on earth has the divine blessing, the Lord bless thee and keep thee, to do with the... I'm breaking up. What on earth has the divine blessing got to do with a list of jewelry like that? The 10th chapter of Jeremiah, beginning of the chapter, describes the production of graven images. And we know from the book of Kings that throughout this period there were plenty of effigies of different gods, Canaanite gods, made throughout the land. And in the beginning of this 10th chapter of Jeremiah, the prophet describes the making of one of these images. And the prophet says that when you have carved this image, be it out of wood or stone or whatever, after that has been made, it's highlighted by applying silver or gold. Now, the gold treatment we know very well, and there's plenty of it. The Egyptians used it. The way of producing the ark, or the technique which was used by the Egyptians, where you'd carve a rough surface, put a layer of plaster on it to smooth it out, and then lay gold leaf on it. Well, you can't beat silver to quite the same degree, but you can beat silver out until it's thin as well. And now... Where are we? We're in chapter 9, verse 9 of chapter 10 of Jeremiah. Silver spread into plates is the phrase that I have in my translation. I don't know what you've got in yours, but that's not a particularly good translation. All the word plate indicates is that it's some sort of layer. Now, Gabriel Bachai, the archaeologist that dug up these tombs, insists that this was beaten silver. Silver beaten to a very thin layer. And then the sheets of thin silver leaf were used for a number of purposes. One of the things they were used for was to highlight the effigies which were carved of the Canaanite gods. That's one of the things. What was the other? Well, the other was here. In this tomb. And the other thing that we have, the detail which could be carved onto metal objects, is referred to again in Jeremiah, a little later on, 17th chapter, beginning of the first verse. And it says there that with an iron pen with a diamond tip, their sins were carved into their hearts. That's the idea which Jeremiah raises. So the technology is there. I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they put a fine, hard, jewel point on a stylus, metal stylus, and that period in history. But apparently they did. Jeremiah says they did. And the things that were found in that tomb also say that they could do it. So on the one hand, these tools were used to decorate false gods. And Jeremiah says, well, the same things then are reminiscent of what's going on in you. And so your misdeeds are written on your heart with these tools. But also here on these silver amulets then, they were little sheets of silver which were rolled up. And inside, on the inside of those, was written with a fine stylus. At these words, which we'll put up now. There were two of them. And it's interesting to think, how were they used? What was done with them? Were they simply made and buried with somebody? I mean, there was a sheet that was rolled up fine, and there was a hole inside it. And the thought is that one could then pass a thread of some kind through the center of that, and so you could hang it on a string. So what might somebody have done with it? They may very well have worn it as a pendant during their life. And they may very well have carried then with them through life words which we have partially translated because the brackets indicate bits that are not clear. And there are also, this one has how many lines? There are three lines missing. So we're not quite sure exactly what the total of the translation is. But this is similar to the idea that was carried by when the priest had on his frontlet the idea of a phylactery, which was carried with them so that the word of God should be in front of them at all times. But it's interesting that these words then were found in a cave, in a burial chamber, and that they must have been a very prized possession of the individual who was buried there. Well, let's just sort of back up for a second and think about what it may mean. And the other thing, I had intended to tell you not to look it up when it goes on there, because you'll all recognize it. But it's not quite what you expected to see. And just think for a few minutes about what you expected to see and why it's not there. Because some of the other words that come clearly from other parts of Scripture. And what it means then to have something which is not quite what we have written. And yet it was a valued piece of someone's life and ideas and words which they kept close to them, presumably, as we might say today, close to their heart. So what then are we looking at here? And what's the significance of it? Well, I read you a section of Isaiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls Bibles, and the earliest known scroll is around 250, possibly as early as 300 BC, but 250 seems to be a better date. And prior to that, there are only one or two very minor little bits of words which appear to be scripturally oriented which have been found. There's certainly quite a bit of writing, things like the Lachish letters are known from the period before this, but they don't have any scripture in them. They were just messages which went back and forth during the Assyrian conquest. These verses here are the closest thing that we have to an extended piece of what looks like a Bible record. Certainly the earliest known examples. And that makes one think then quite seriously about the validity of the biblical text. And this is a topic which has interested me quite a bit recently. I've been reading quite a lot on criticism, textual criticisms and so forth. And it's quite fascinating to see the way people's minds work. And yet when I got hold of this, it seemed to me that we were starting to look at something which must make people go back and look very seriously at the authenticity of the text. Because, as we said, you can write a story about time gone by. You can get it generally right. There's, things that I remember from what my grandmother told me and in this rough history and so forth. You can remember and you can come up with a quickie story, but how many of the people's names from that period do you get right? And there was one. You didn't expect to find it, but there it was. And there can be little doubt that somebody called Pelatiah lived in that period. We wonder whether what the sophistication of their metalworking was. And there's the evidence. A very thin sheet of silver, which was rolled up, and it took ages to get it unrolled because of the corrosion that had gone on over the years. But that is a technique which we have trouble duplicating today. I don't know whether you've tried to drill holes in stones and things like that. You know, when I was a kid, I used to do all kinds of strange things like that. But have you ever tried to drill a hole in an agate? How did they make those beads? The carnelian's quite hard. And many of the other stones which were used as semi-precious jewels. And they have holes drilled in them, and they're either bracelets or anklets or necklaces. How did they do it? And yet, you see, they did. And so when Isaiah or Ezekiel talks about those things, it does describe the things that were going on at that time. The text fits the history and it fits the archaeology. And not only that, we're now beginning to see that the words in the text, that some of them have been questioned by authorities many times. The words in the text also fit what we find in our scriptures. I've got to put my glasses on. I can't find the word I want. Blessing. Like this. If you look at that word, now this is the one that springs to mind when we think of the Lord, bless thee and keep thee. Now this is the word that springs to mind. If you look at the way that word is used throughout the Old Testament, you find it quite a bit in Genesis. You find it quite a lot in the other four books of Moses. And then as you work your way down through Scripture, it's used less and less and less. It's only three times in Jeremiah, for instance. A couple of times in Isaiah, and so I forget the number in Ezekiel. But the number of usages of that word declines as you get closer to the beginning of the New Testament. Why? Well, there's one major exception to that, and that's in the Psalms. There's one place where the word blessing is used extensively. It's used in more times in the Psalms than in any of the other books. And in some versions of this word, it's used more times than the other books combined. I'd like to look quite quickly at Psalm 67. God be merciful unto us and bless us. Cause his face to shine upon us, that thy way may be known, it goes on. And then in the last verse in that psalm, God shall bless us, and all the ends of the earth shall fear him. God shall bless us, and all the ends of the earth shall fear him. God be merciful unto us, and bless us. We know from the historical writings around the time of Christ that the psalms were used the way we use hymns in our meeting in the service of the temple. There are records in the historical books in the Old Testament of the music that was developed for the first temple. And so there's no reason to doubt that psalms were not used also. In fact, one of the psalms is quoted directly, and the singers in the temple sang that particular psalm. We know from then from the New Testament and parallel histories, and we know from the Old Testament historical books that the Psalms were used as part of temple worship. And as I said to you, this thought that the Lord shall bless thee under certain circumstances, and that the blessing of the Lord would go with you, the concept of God making his face to shine upon us is also quite prevalent among the Psalms. The idea of God's graciousness being extended is quite prevalent in the Psalms. And so when you think about what is read there, it's quite likely that what is being referred to is a composite of things that were heard when they went to the temple. Because not only that, at the end of the temple service, it is not known for sure, but quite probably that the priestly blessing was extended on the people. That's the indication from the law that the blessing should be used that way. We don't know whether the Jewish people actually did that all the time, but it's quite likely and it's quite probable that they did. So what you're probably seeing when you look at these verses are things that people had listened to and heard many times. The great God who keeps the covenant and mercy is the word in my translation, and that's in Deuteronomy chapter 7. The great God who keeps covenant and graciousness toward those who love him and keep his commandments. Deuteronomy chapter 7, almost exact. A blessing more than any. And where did this little piece come from? Where did this little piece come from? Well, it's obviously somebody asking for protection, for God's support, for God's help in the things that can go wrong in life. Why they chose those particular words, I don't know. I can't see a verse that captures those verses right close together like that. But certainly what was being hoped for was that God would be with them in life and would take care of them in spite of the problems that were surrounding them. For redemption is in him. Yahweh is our restorer and rock. And there's a good word which we find several times in the Psalms. May Yahweh bless you. May he keep you. Make his face to shine upon you, and I don't know whether they shorten it by saying, and give you peace, as I tend to do, or whether the balance of the verse would be quoted. But there we have a combination of a number of ideas which are found in the Psalms, and the priestly blessing, which is there. From Numbers. There were two of those little amulets, one smaller than another. And as we said, they were prepared in the same manner. They were developed by beating silver into thin sheets, laying it out flat, taking a very fine stylus and writing the words on it, and then rolling it up with a space in the middle so that it could be held, supported on a thread, on a string, on a piece of leather, or whatever they may have used. This piece in the center here is quite interesting. And we're going to go back to the grave contents in a second. Because, and what I want you to do is think about something which we mentioned a few minutes ago from Jeremiah, that the people were taking wood and stone, cutting graven images. And the message which Jeremiah develops from that is that there's a wooden object, but what good is it? It's dead. It's not a real God. Doesn't matter how you dress it up. It's not a real God. And yet that's what everybody around them was doing. And we know from Kings, particularly, that there were plenty of Asa's mother-in-law, for instance, developed her own private goddess in her living quarters. And that was a carving, that was an effigy. And there's also another case of a tomb from the same general period, which was out towards Lachish. It was a rock carved, a cave which had been enlarged and used as a burial chamber. And inscriptions on the wall in that cave were that may God care for them in the afterlife, and may Asherah also care for them in the afterlife. So the male and female deities were side by side, at least in some of the Jewish population at this time. So remember what we said earlier is that this beaten silver was used in many cases to decorate effigies, and in other cases it was used to prepare religious amulets, to remind people of the words which they heard in the temple. So where did the concept of God as a warrior come from? Where did the concept of God as a rebuker? Now that's a word which we can find in the Old Testament. But the warrior God, well, there are times when God certainly poured forth his fury on the nations round about. There were times when the Israelites felt it. But the concept which we have of God is not the same as the concept which the Canaanites had of Baal. Baal was the god that rode in on the tempest. Baal was the warrior. Baal was the god that came with a destroying force. And Baal was recognized in the Jewish community as well as Yahweh. The rebuke of evil. May Yahweh bless you, keep you. May Yahweh make his face shine upon you and grant you, and that last word is almost certainly peace, even though it is not complete. May Yahweh grant you peace. So, as we said, these texts, and there's one other from the Sinai Peninsula, which has the first couple of lines of that great priestly blessing. So the words were known. The words were known during the First Temple period. The words were recorded during the First Temple period. And so the indications are that the text was there, the Psalms were there, much of the rest of it, even though textual scholars may doubt that. And we say the content of the tomb indicates that indeed the things which were going on and which were recorded in the in the writings of the prophets is evidenced by what we see in the tomb. So what I want you to do now is look at all the pottery. Now, we talked a little bit about the amphoriscos, which is just a small amphora, which was very expensive and very elaborately prepared. Look at this little thing here, the alabastra. They're made of clay. They're not really alabaster. They're just copies. So what were they originally? They were perfume containers made of alabaster. So in life, you would have a nice, and we have some alabaster which we bought when we were in Egypt, and it has very nice properties. It handles light very well. It's a very attractive stone. And so it was a very interesting and a very attractive item on a lady's vanity, shall we say. And the contents of that would be her perfume, or maybe some of the skin creams that they had, and they had many creams which were based on olive oil in those early days, which were used in much the same way that all of us use things nowadays when we get chapped skins and so forth. But why bury items like that with the deceased? You see, one thing that these tomb contents show us was that the words of the Old Testament were there and they were being used. But the other thing that the tomb contents show us is that all the things that the prophets didn't like about those people was also very much in vogue. As we said, the silver was used for images of gods, and it was also used for things like this. Why put all of those items in the tomb? I'm going to leave you with a question for a second. Why do it? Well, the Egyptians did it. The Assyrians did it. The Babylonians did it. Not the Babylonians and Assyrians. They didn't go mad the way the Egyptians did. I mean, if you look at what's in, and King Tut was a very minor little king. I don't know. Years ago, they had an exhibit in the Seattle Art Museum of the King Tut exposition, which toured North America. And a group of us went down there. The Blackers organized the trip, and we took a bus, went down, and looked at the contents of the tomb. And years later, when we got to Cairo, went into the Cairo Museum, we went into the room which was devoted to the King Tut's exhibit, and stuff was just piled in corners. There's so much stuff there that they would need a room two or three times bigger than this to display it in a way that you could walk around and have a number of people look at it. They had showcases, you know, these typical old-style showcases, and things just spread in them thickly. you could hardly see what they were. They were piled almost one on top of another. There was that much stuff which went with King Tut to be used in his afterlife. Last time we were in Britain, this in December, I picked up a little figure of Samtek. little figure, Shrapti figure, which was put in the tomb, and it represented the one who had died and the pharaoh who was in the tomb. And the Shrapti figure was to do the work of the pharaoh in the afterlife. Do you see what I'm suggesting here? That there was a reason that Isaiah said what he did. There was a reason that Jeremiah sounded so negative. There was a reason for what Ezekiel said had come down on this people when he was in Babylon. And it was that they were thinking more and more like the people around them. And yet they hung on. They hung on to their bits of text which we had up there, and may the Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee. They hung on to those ideas, and yet they took with them all the ideas of the world around. So however you look at what was going on in that society, it's exactly what we see written here. And the more we dig, and the more we search, and the more we investigate what's going on here, we find that the stories which are recorded for us in our Old Testament are very much true for what happened in that day. There's no reason to doubt the prophets. And also, there's every reason to believe that these texts have come to us from many years, that they are valid, that they were in extant when the prophets said they were, and that we now, thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls and so forth, realize that they are going to stay with us for many years to come. Oh, thanks, and I'm sorry I'm falling apart, but I find these things very interesting, particularly when they indicate to you that what you read does make sense. I hope that you have the same interests.